This is Writer's Voice, in-depth conversations with writers of all genres. This Thanksgiving week, we honor not the European colonists who came to conquer a land that was not their own, but the indigenous people they plundered and killed, and yet who remain among us. In other words, the real story behind Thanksgiving. And it's a story my guest Rebecca Nagel says we ignore at our own peril.
And one of the arguments that I make in the book is this idea that tribal sovereignty is like the canary in the coal mine in U.S. democracy, which is actually a quote from an early scholar of federal Indian law named Felix Cohen. And I think that we can really see that with the Supreme Court, because some of these trends that a larger portion of the U.S. population is feeling now when it comes to the court were happening with tribes literally decades ago. And things may have gone differently if more people had been paying attention.
Nagel's book is By the Fire We Carry, the generations-long fight for justice on Native land. We also honor our Indigenous Peoples Day tradition of listening to Native American ethnohistorian Marge Bruschak tell us the story of corn she learned from her Abenaki ancestors. That's all on the menu this week for Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Rebecca Nagel's ancestors were leaders of the Cherokee Nation, before the Cherokee people were ethnically cleansed from their homelands in the southeastern U.S. under the Indian Removal Act. Five tribes, including the Cherokees, were forced to migrate westward to Oklahoma on the Trail of Tears. But the territory they were promised in perpetuity was eaten away and plundered by hordes of white invaders who established the state of Oklahoma. Fast forward to 2020, when the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a stunning decision that acknowledged the sovereignty of Indian Territory in Oklahoma, and by extension, of all treaty territories granted to indigenous tribes throughout the U.S. It was a stunning ruling because, for the first time since the treaties were written, the U.S. Supreme Court actually upheld the law. At a time now when the rule of law applying to all Americans is under assault from the MAGA movement and former and future President Donald Trump, we would do well to heed the history of how the law has been flagrantly ignored throughout centuries of settler colonialism and how indigenous tribes never gave up the fight for their rights. In her book, By the Fire We Carry, Rebecca Nagel unpacks the history of the Cherokee Nation and broader indigenous struggles for sovereignty, drawing lessons from it about the myth and reality of American democracy itself. Nagel is an award-winning reporter, writer, and citizen of the Cherokee Nation. She's the creator and host of Crooked Media's chart-topping podcast, This Land. Her work has been featured in The Atlantic, The Washington Post, and The Guardian, among other outlets. Nagel lives in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Rebecca Nagel, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
So in By the Fire We Carry, the story you tell runs on two tracks that are intertwined. The 2020 Supreme Court decision that affirmed the reality of the treaties establishing Indian land reservations in Oklahoma, and the historical context within which that decision was situated. So that is, you know, I'll be asking you a lot of questions about both those things. But first, I want to ask you about your own personal connection to this story and to this historical context. Tell us about yourself and your family and your connection to several key figures in the history of your tribe.
When I first learned about the court case, long before it went to the Supreme Court, I felt this visceral sense of justice at the possibility that the land that my ancestors had died for could be recognized as Cherokee land for the first time in over a century. And to put some context behind that, the actual court case was about the reservation of a neighboring tribe called Muscogee Nation. But there was this wide-held belief that whatever the court said about Muscogee Nation would apply to Cherokee Nation too. And my ancestors, John and Major Ridge, signed our treaty, our tribe's removal treaty. And that's what established our land here in what is now Oklahoma. But that decision was really controversial. The majority of Cherokee people opposed leaving our homelands. At the time in the 1830s, the state of Georgia was harassing Cherokees on our land and basically trying to make life in our homeland so unbearable that we would agree to move. We actually won a Supreme Court decision that said Georgia couldn't do that, that it was illegal and that they had to stop. But the state and President Andrew Jackson decided to ignore the decision. After that, and after years of countless efforts to try and protect Cherokee land, my family decided that if we stayed, we wouldn't survive. They thought the only way that Cherokees as a people and as a nation would survive was to move west. And so against the will and the government of the Cherokee people, they signed the Treaty of New Echota. What followed that treaty was the Trail of Tears, and a quarter of the Cherokee population died, and they blamed my family for those losses. And in June of 1839, both John and Major Ridge were assassinated. So it's, you know, a pretty complicated story. I think there's a lot going on in it. And as a writer and as a descendant of theirs, you know, I tried to, in the book, grapple with what does this family legacy and what does this history mean? And, you know, where I came down, I think that the Ridges made the wrong decision for the right reason. I think it was wrong for them to go against, you know, the government and the will of our tribe. But at the same time, I think they were doing it for patriotic reasons, you know, to try and save Cherokee Nation in the best way that they saw possible. And I think what we can learn from their story is what our ancestors were facing at this time, and how, I mean, they were literally fighting off, sometimes with each other, often with each other. But what they were fighting over was the best way to survive this policy of ethnic cleansing and genocide. And I think it shows us the level of violence the U.S. was committing against Indigenous peoples at this time.
Yes, and that level of violence, that genocide, that ethnic cleansing, there is a through line in your book, or question, I would say, that is basic, that asks, what kind of a democracy do we have when in such a central way it is founded on genocide and ethnic cleansing? It's founded on this history of incredible brutality against Indigenous peoples. So I've grappled a lot with this, and I've been grappling a lot with this question recently, because we are now facing, you know, a more general end of democracy in this country. It's been eroding for a long time. But from your perspective, say a little bit about what you wanted American, you know, readers to take away from this book about that question of democracy.
Yeah, you know, I think often U.S. citizens think that the history of genocide and dispossession of Indigenous nations and the ongoing, you know, violation of treaties, violation of sovereignty is a problem for us as an Indigenous people. You know, it's a problem for those tribes. And, you know, one of the key arguments that the book makes is it's a problem for U.S. democracy. And it's not something that exists in a silo. You know, one of the patterns that we see with how the U.S. government treats tribes and indigenous nations is that even when there are laws in place that clearly protect the tribe, if a bunch of non-native people or a state wants something that belongs to the tribe, over and over again, what our government has done has bent or broken the rules to satisfy that greed. And, you know, if you think that your government can be lawless towards one group of people, but never towards you, I don't think that's the way that works. The other pattern that I talk about in the book, and I really relied heavily on the scholarship of a legal scholar named Maggie Blackhawk. And she talks about how, you know, when our country was founded, if you go all the way back to the origin, you know, our founding fathers wanted a democracy where every citizen and person would have a voice and a vote. But they also wanted an empire. And so the Constitution and the government that they built did both. And as long as we have been a country, we have controlled the lands and the lives of people who have no say, whether it's Indigenous nations or Guam or Puerto Rico or migrants detained at our borders. There have always been people who lived under the raw power of our government, but not the protections and the privileges of our Constitution. And what I would say is that I think that our inheritance as U.S. citizens is a democracy that at times can be wildly anti-democratic. It is a government that has ruled both by consent and by conquest.
And this book, this wonderful book, By the Fire We Carry, Rebecca Nagel, really describes that whole trajectory and that contradiction in detail. It's quite wonderful. Now, before we go on, just tell us about the title, By the Fire We Carry.
Yeah, it was inspired by a poem by Joy Harjo called Returning from the Enemy. And the specific line from the poem is, I keep warm by the fire carried through cruelty. And Harjo's referring to, you know, one of the things that unites us as people who are Southeastern Indigenous folks is our fire. So sometimes you'll hear the phrase one fire, but we kept fires. And during our forced removal, during the Trail of Tears, those fires were brought to what is now Oklahoma, and they are still tended and cared for. And so the title literally references those fires, but it also is about, I think, the sort of metaphor of fire, of this fight for sovereignty and justice, and how generations of Indigenous people have also tended to that fight and kept that metaphorical fire alive.
And these fires are in honor of your ancestors, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's complicated. I don't think that there's one way to describe them, but they're at the center of, you know, for folks who are still ceremonial, they're still at the center of our ceremonial grounds and in our traditional towns, you know, and even in our traditional societies, you know, they were our mother towns, you know, the fire was one of the things that would, you know, unite us all as Cherokee people.
So now let's talk about what the Indian Removal Act did. How did it set up, and what were the treaties that set up indigenous lands in Oklahoma, which was a destination point for the Trail of Tears?
Yeah, so by the late 1820s, southern states coveted indigenous land. And the biggest land holdings in the South were the Cherokee, the Chickasaw, the Choctaw, the Muscogee, and the Seminole. And some southern states, you know, half to a quarter of their land was still the treaty territory of these tribes. And they wanted to basically get rid of them. And in 1828, they got a friend in the White House by the name of Andrew Jackson. And Andrew Jackson's signature policy was the Indian Removal Act, which was what it was called once it got to Congress. And it wasn't just those five tribes, it was all indigenous nations living what was kind of basically then, you know, the United States. And it was this idea that they would be relocated to west of the Mississippi. And just to give a sense of scale, you know, at the time, this was 80,000 indigenous people, which on the scale of U.S. population today, it would be like forcibly relocating the entire population of Houston. It was a very expensive project. There were multiple years during the 1830s where it was almost half of the entire federal budget. And I think another thing that gets lost in the way that we tell the story, I think we think that generations of Americans just uniformly wanted to, you know, kill indigenous people, and it was just this blanket policy. But actually, at the time, this policy was extremely controversial. The opposition to it was big. You know, people organized the largest petition drive in U.S. history. It was actually part of the opposition was the first national political action taken by women. Women organized a big petition drive, and the bill just barely passed the House. And what followed that bill were individual treaties with tribes. So the executive, Andrew Jackson, still had to treat with the tribes for the tribes to remove. And so what followed the Indian Removal Act was really a pressure campaign on the tribes to force them to sign treaties. And so, you know, the political circumstances and exactly what happened in each tribe is a little different. You know, like I said, for my tribe, Cherokee Nation, you know, my ancestors at a certain point, actually, they fought the Indian Removal Act and then they were still fighting. And then it was a few years later that they decided that there was really nothing else that the tribe could do if they wanted to survive and they wanted to continue to exist as a people and a nation other than move west.
And the Supreme Court actually ruled against this. Is that right? Do I have that correct? Against the Indian Removal Act, or am I confused with that?
Yeah. So the Supreme Court ruling, it was a little bit different. So the Indian Removal Act gave President Andrew Jackson authority to treat with the tribes to, you know, get them to move west, but it didn't force the tribes to the table. So the tribes still had to basically consent. Well, you know, and that consent, southern states decided would be bullied out of the tribe. And so Georgia passed a series of harassment laws where it even had a special militia that it banded together to harass Cherokees on Cherokee land to try and force them to decide to go. So, you know, it outlawed Cherokee Nation's government from functioning. It outlawed Cherokees from mining gold on their land. And under one of those harassment laws, they actually arrested a white missionary, and his case was the case that went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court was specifically telling Georgia that it had to stop. But that was sort of the main tactic that Southern states used to force indigenous nations to go west, was to make life on their lands so unbearable that they would have no other choice.
And so when they got to Oklahoma, what did the treaty guarantee the tribes? And how should I refer to, because you're talking about the Cherokee and the Muscogee, is there one general term or that I should use?
Yeah, I mean, so each tribe had a different treaty. Some tribes actually had multiple treaties, and the treaties all have, you know, different names, where you're talking about, you know, the Treaty of Indian Springs or the Treaty of New Echota. But yeah, so I think sometimes people call them like our removal treaties if we want to talk about them, you know, in a group. And so, and again, you know, each treaty is going to have different specificities, but, you know, some of the things that were in the Treaty of New Echota that my ancestors signed was that, you know, Cherokee Nation would never be a part of any state or any U.S. territory without the tribe's consent, which is a treaty stipulation that still has never been met by the U.S. government. It gave us a delegate to the U.S. Congress, and we've never had that person sat in the House, which is actually a demand our tribe still has. But the biggest thing was, you know, the exchange of land. And so the treaty set aside land for the tribes west of the Mississippi in what at the time was called Indian Territory, and what would later, you know, in violation of those treaties, become the state of Oklahoma.
So now you make pretty clear that the history of capitalism in this country is really fundamental to this story, because the push for white settlers into the Oklahoma Territory began with the cotton economy first, and then later on there was the oil boom. So talk about the economic pressure. You know, what was the greed that drove that? It wasn't just that people were looking for, you know, some more acres to farm.
Yeah. I mean, you know, for tribes like especially the Chickasaw and the Choctaw, the demand to expand the slave economy in the South and for prime cotton land was a big part of the motivation while they were pushed off their land. For Cherokees, one of the pivotal moments in our history was when gold was discovered on our homelands, and we were just swarmed by illegal settlers who took literally tens of millions of dollars of gold out of our land, which didn't belong to them. And then fast forward to when we were on our lands in Oklahoma, when Oklahoma was becoming a state, oil prospectors flocked there and started drilling for oil. And within a few years, they found some of the most productive wells in the United States, in places like Glenpool and Red Fork. And what happened was so allotment, just to back up for a minute. So originally our tribes had owned our land communally, and allotment was a policy that came and divided up tribal land so that each individual citizen owned a portion of the land. So it was kind of like, if you think about a sheet cake, allotment came and cut the cake into small pieces. And instead of the land being held collectively by the tribe, each citizen owns their individual piece. And so some citizens were unfortunate, and I say unfortunate because of what happened, for oil to be discovered on the piece of land that they owned. And instead of benefiting from that, what happened was there was a level of rampant crime and fraud and violence to take that land away from Native Alatis. And so people were kidnapped, people were sexually assaulted, physically assaulted, murdered in their sleep. You know, people forged documents, forged wills. And so there was a lot of predation on tribal citizens right at the turn of the century, at the beginning of Oklahoma. And the book goes into that, and particularly the story of one Muscogee woman named Millie Naharkey, who was actually kidnapped right before she turned 18 so that an oil prospector could get her to sign away her land before her, or right after her 18th birthday. And I think, you know, going back to capitalism, one of the big lessons, you know, I think we are taught or told certain messages about capitalism and hard work and sort of pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And I think what allotment shows is there was this moment that Native people actually did have a lot of wealth, and that wealth was stolen. And I think it shows how capitalism works, where some people are allowed to make a profit and make money sort of almost by any means necessary, and other people's wealth, when they do have it, is pilfered.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Native American journalist and author Rebecca Nagel about her book, By the Fire We Carry: The Generations-Long Fight for Justice on Native Land. Millie Naharkey, I mean, it's a heartbreaking story. She was judged incompetent once she attained majority. This had nothing to do with her actual mental capacity. Talk about the kind of shenanigans, you know, from declaring incompetency to murder. I mean, a lot of this is also talked about in the book, what is that book by David Grant?
Killers of the Flower Moon.
Killers of the Flower Moon, exactly, that book by David Graham. Talk about the kinds of different ways in which this land was plundered.
Yeah, so like I said, Millie Naharki, her story is really tragic. You can kind of see how allotment followed somebody really from the cradle to the grave. So she was a baby when allotment happened and when oil was discovered on her family's land. And actually what happened when she was just before she was 18 months old is that her dad died, and we don't know how or why he died. But we do know that it was right after his mom and his first wife died. So three members of Millie's family died within a few years once allotment got started. And we do know we there's no evidence that they were murdered, but we do know that murder was very common. Was a common tactic at this time. And this wasn't uncommon. So Millie had a guardian when she was a child. And this was a policy Congress came up with. Instead of Native parents controlling children's estates, Congress decided that Native parents just didn't know what they were doing, and there would be court-appointed guardians. And these court-appointed guardians, who are usually white, would basically embezzle money from the children's estates. And Millie's guardian absolutely did that. You know, he would borrow money from her estate and never pay it back. You know, Millie would pay for his car to get serviced and all of these kinds of expenses. But once she turned 18, she was supposed to have control over her own land. And so an oil prospector kidnapped her, took her out of state to try and trick her into signing away her land right after she turned 18, sort of away from her guardian and away from anyone who could intervene. So after 3 months, she finally got back to Oklahoma. The kidnapping was over, but her saga wasn't, because, you know, 10 days after her abduction ended, a Tulsa County judge declared her legally incompetent. And so what that meant was that she still had a guardian. So any money that came from her land, if she wanted to spend it, she had to basically ask permission. And so I went through her probate records and found the records where she had to ask permission to buy dentures, to install a garbage disposal, to visit a sick relative in another state, to buy pillowcases and towels and a coat and Christmas presents. Millie Naharki died in 1996, and she had a guardian until she died. And so I think a lot of times people think that this is, you know, distant history, that it's stuff that happened a long time ago. But these policies come up very close to the present day. And that declaring someone incompetent if they were Native in Oklahoma at this time was very, very common, especially if their land was valuable. And so while Millie Naharki's story is tragic, it's actually not uncommon.
Yeah, and just briefly, I mean, this kind of control also that extends to today. I mean, the tribes, you know, the vast majority of oil and gas wells you point out in the book, Rebecca Nagel, you point out in the By the Fire We Carry, the vast majority of the oil and gas wells are in fact spent wells, but they're leaking. They're leaking methane, they're leaking oil, all serious contributors to climate. And yet, the tribes do not have the power to regulate those emissions or anything that happens with them. So it's almost like, you could say the state of Oklahoma has taken over guardianship, or took over guardianship a long time ago and has tried to maintain it in spite of the Supreme Court rulings, which we'll get to in a moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Tribes have really limited what's called civil jurisdiction, but really limited civil jurisdiction on our reservations here in eastern Oklahoma.
So let's talk about the Supreme Court case and how it began. It began with a murder. It began with a crime. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so in August of 1999, a Muskogee citizen named Patrick Murphy murdered a fellow Muskogee citizen named George Jacobs. The murder was pretty brutal, pretty violent. And in 2000, Patrick Murphy was found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to death. And, you know, the case would become really complicated and involve, you know, the state and the tribes and members of Congress and the oil and gas industry. But at its beginning stage, the conflict was simple. Oklahoma wanted to execute Patrick Murphy for the murder of George Jacobs, but Patrick wanted to live. And a few years later, a federal public defender got her hands on Patrick's case, and she started from scratch. You know, she sort of reinvestigated the whole case from top to bottom to see if any of his previous lawyers had missed something. And it was a good thing she did, because they missed this question of jurisdiction. So, you know, prosecutors can't prosecute anybody who lives anywhere. They only have specific jurisdiction over geographical areas. And jurisdiction works differently on tribal land. So states don't have jurisdiction to prosecute Native people who commit crimes on tribal land. Only the federal government or the tribes have that jurisdiction. And so when this public defender started digging into it and working with some other lawyers, she came up with this novel legal theory that Oklahoma hadn't had the jurisdiction to prosecute Patrick and didn't have the jurisdiction to execute him because the crime actually happened on the reservation of Muscogee Nation. Now, Oklahoma countered and said, wait a minute, you know, this reservation hasn't been acknowledged in over 100 years. It would be ridiculous to say that it still exists. You know, there are no reservations here in eastern Oklahoma. But what the legal team for Patrick Murphy and the tribe argued was, you know, the way the law works is that only Congress can get rid of a reservation. A state, you know, can't alter treaty rights. Congress has to do it, and they have to put it in writing. And when they went back through the laws and the history, they couldn't find an act of Congress that did. And so that question of whether or not Muscogee Nation still had a reservation eventually went all the way to the Supreme Court. And so it took a very long time. It took 20 years from the original death sentence to the Supreme Court decision. But, you know, that was sort of the circuitous route that it took and how, you know, we got to this historic Supreme Court decision.
Yeah, and what an interesting decision it was in the sense of who was responsible for the way it went. Talk about Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the one hand and her, let's say, contradictory maybe approach to the rights in question. And then talk about Neil Gorsuch, because those who did pay attention to this know that he played the key role in the decision.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people assume that Native issues might follow party lines, as party is in Democrat and Republican, and they just don't. And I think the Supreme Court is a great example. And so the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg had a really mixed record when it came to tribes and tribal sovereignty, and she authored an opinion called the Sherrill Decision, which was really detrimental to tribal sovereignty. And a lot of people felt, you know, was just also a poor reading of the law. Meanwhile, Justice Gorsuch, who is a Trump appointee, has been a real champion of tribal sovereignty since he was on the bench. He had a good background with tribes at the 10th Circuit and has this very clear view that when the law protects the rights of a tribe, it's not up to the courts to rewrite the law. The only thing the courts should do is follow the law, which sounds basic, but unfortunately, when it comes to tribes, it's not. And so I think arguably Ruth Bader Ginsburg was the swing vote in the case. She did end up voting for Muscogee Nation. And then Justice Gorsuch actually authored the opinion and wrote the opinion, which began with this incredible line. You know, he starts the opinion by saying, on the far end of the Trail of Tears was a promise, and talks about how the Supreme Court is there to hold the government to its word. And so it was a really, really powerful opinion.
But that opinion actually, maybe was not the most important one. There was another case, the McGirt case. Why did that come up? What did that do? So just tell us the story of the two cases. Why one didn't do exactly what was promised and the other one, well, let's see what happens with that.
Yeah, so Patrick Murphy's case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And actually, Gorsuch didn't participate in that case because he had participated in it at the 10th Circuit in a procedural vote. And so he recused himself, which is sort of a normal run of how things work. And so it was actually, you know, it was the summer after the case had been argued and everyone's, you know, on SCOTUS blog, on the Supreme Court website, hitting refresh, waiting to see what the opinion is going to be. It's actually the last opinion to get announced for the entire term. And then the Chief Justice from the bench says Murphy will be rescheduled for re-argument. And everybody was just sort of scratching their heads and saying, why? What happened? And people guessed, and I think it's a very reasonable guess, that the court had been locked in a 4-4 vote because without Gorsuch, they had an even 8 justices. And so they could have still, you know, just upheld the 10th Circuit decision. But if they wanted to write their own opinion in the case, they couldn't do that with a 4-4. And so when Patrick Murphy won in the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, which is one step below the Supreme Court, a bunch of inmates in Oklahoma started filing their own appeals saying, wait a minute, you know, here's this man on death row who the 10th Circuit is saying Oklahoma can't prosecute. I'm Native. My crime happened on a reservation. Maybe Oklahoma can't prosecute me either. One of those inmates was a man named Jim C. McGirt, who was serving what was basically a life sentence for sexually abusing his wife's granddaughter, to his step-granddaughter. And he, without a lawyer, with just kind of a team of jailhouse lawyers that he was working with, filed his own appeal, was sort of denied in all of the Oklahoma courts, and appealed his case all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court decided to take it. And so he didn't have a lawyer until the Supreme Court granted cert, which is also very rare in the Supreme Court, the way the Supreme Court works. But because the case had come up through Oklahoma and Gorsuch, I hadn't been through the 10th Circuit at all. Gorsuch was allowed to join the case and then, of course, ultimately authored the opinion.
So that opinion was the key one. What was the impact on tribes other than the Muscogee or the tribes in Oklahoma?
So the opinion, the Supreme Court opinion, was just about the reservation of Muscogee Nation, which is about 3 million acres or about the size of Connecticut. But what happened after the Supreme Court made its ruling is that lower courts in Oklahoma interpreted that ruling as it applied to other cases. And so 8 other reservations in the state were eventually upheld, including my tribe's reservation, Cherokee Nation. The big reservations, there are some smaller reservations in the northeastern corner of the state, but the big reservations were the reservations of the Cherokee, the Muscogee, the Chickasaw, the Choctaw, and the Seminole. And when you put those reservations together, the area covers almost half of the land in Oklahoma, most of the city of Tulsa, the second largest city in Oklahoma. It is an area that is 19 million acres, which is larger than West Virginia and 9 other U.S. states. And it represents the largest restoration of tribal land in U.S. history. And so I think that's part of the history and the significance of this case of land that legally belonged to tribes, but had been denied for over a century. And to have that restored has actually been very, very rare in American history.
So as you point out in the book, Rebecca Nagel, as you point out in By the Fire We Carry, after this decision came down, the state of Oklahoma had a tantrum. So what was the actual practical impact of this, and what was that tantrum all about?
Yeah. So I think the tantrum was about not wanting to share power with tribes and not wanting to give up even an inch of power. And I think a lot of people think that reservations come with more power than they actually do. But except for limited circumstances, tribes don't have a lot of criminal or civil jurisdiction over non-natives. So that means that folks who aren't native on tribal land, you know, the tribe can't really tax them, regulate their businesses, or even prosecute them for most crimes. And so most people living in eastern Oklahoma haven't really been affected by the decision. Where there was a big shift is, again, who is prosecuting crimes committed by Native people. And so that jurisdiction shifted to either the tribe or the federal government. And that's been the biggest impact. So Oklahoma did not like the McGirt decision, still does not like the McGirt decision. We have a governor who has basically fought it at every opportunity and every turn. At first, they kind of went to Congress to say, okay, you know, the Supreme Court said Congress had never gotten rid of the reservations, but maybe they would now. That didn't get very far. And so Oklahoma actually went back to the Supreme Court and took really the unprecedented move and radical move of asking the court to overturn a decision they had just made. And Oklahoma asked the Supreme Court to overturn their recent decision over 50 times. The Supreme Court didn't do that. They didn't reverse McGirt, but they gave Oklahoma back a small slice of the jurisdictional power that they had lost. I sort of sometimes call it like the McGirt cookie. You know, they sort of threw Oklahoma a bone. But unfortunately, that decision has implication for tribes nationwide, and the sort of tangled mess of how jurisdiction works on reservations has had really devastating impacts for the safety of Native people. Long story short, that Supreme Court decision, Castro Huerta, which came out in 2022, I believe, that decision sort of just made that tangle mess worse.
And how does it impact the safety of Native people?
So what the Castro Huerta decision did was it gave states jurisdictional power over non-natives who commit crime over natives. So that used to be in the category of crimes that states couldn't prosecute. So tribes of the federal government would prosecute those crimes, and it gave that jurisdiction back. And some people might say, and this was argued in front of the Supreme Court, great, now there's a crime and the tribe can prosecute the crime, the federal government can prosecute the crime, and the state can prosecute the crime. So with three powers that can prosecute this crime, it's really going to get prosecuted. But unfortunately, Native victims of crime are not priorities for law enforcement. And so when you have shared jurisdiction, instead of having good prosecution, what you see happen is that everybody passes the buck. And that a lot of times those crimes go unprosecuted. And that follows with, you know, even things like police patrol and law enforcement resources that, you know, where there's shared jurisdiction, you know, people just don't want to invest in Native communities and will use it as an excuse to not invest.
And bringing this back to the Supreme Court, the state doing this, you point out that this is, you know, and here's another case where it really implicates our larger democracy, that it's part of a general trend of right-wing led states going back to the Supreme Court to have it undo established law. And I'm sure everybody is now thinking, or they should be, of Roe versus Wade, because that is a clear, glaring example of that. So talk about how this action by Oklahoma is part of this larger trend.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the Supreme Court has started making headlines, especially with the Dobbs decision. But I think if you look at tribal sovereignty, some of these trends that people are concerned about, whether it's states asking the court to do more and more radical decisions, or the court parting from precedent and established law, those are problems that tribes have been dealing with for a long time. You know, if you look even just statistically, tribes or tribal interests have lost the majority of cases that have come before the Supreme Court since the 1950s. Since the 1990s, tribes have lost 2/3 of cases that have gone before the Supreme Court. And there are big issues where tribes have watched the Supreme Court really roll tribal sovereignty and indigenous rights back. And one of the arguments that I make in the book is this idea that tribal sovereignty is like the canary in the coal mine in U.S. democracy, which is actually a quote from an early scholar of federal Indian law named Felix Cohen. And I think that we can really see that with the Supreme Court, because some of these trends that a larger portion of the U.S. population is feeling now when it comes to the court were happening with tribes literally decades ago. And things may have gone differently if more people had been paying attention.
Right. And just to drive home the point, this is really about trying to undo settled law. In other words, trying to undermine the rule of law.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's one of the things that tribes come up against a lot, is that even when the law clearly protects the tribe, you know, the U.S. government is spineless and sort of chucks the law out the window to come to the conclusion that the courts or that a state wants.
And so finally, this has been a centuries-long battle on the part of the five tribes and, of course, many other indigenous tribes in this country that have continued to fight. What lessons and inspiration can we draw from the fight of indigenous peoples in America as we now go into a period of the gravest threat to democracy the nation has ever faced for the general population as a whole?
I think the lesson is that we haven't fixed what is fundamentally wrong with our democracy. To think that our democracy and that our government could commit genocide and that we would never even admit that that happened, take accountability for it, reform our laws. I mean, we've never had a constitutional amendment or a Supreme Court decision that has ended the legal subordination of indigenous nations. You know, our government has never reformed its laws to make sure that these atrocities don't happen again. And I think there's been, maybe not arrogance is the right word, but I think this idea of, you know, progress with our democracy, that, you know, there were these founding flaws, but things have gotten better. And I think that indigenous nations kind of run counter to that idea of progress. I mean, I do think we have, especially since the 70s, made a lot of legislative gains. But I think some of these fundamental problems, you know, with our constitution and with our democracy haven't even begun to be solved. And I think the lesson is that, you know, if you think that this won't come back, you know, if you think we can do these things without consequences for future generations and have these weaknesses in our democracy without it ever coming home to roost, I think that it will. And perhaps, you know, I think the future will tell us it has.
Well, it is a cautionary tale. It is so well told. I actually listened to the audiobook. I think you did a fantastic job of narrating it. The book is By the Fire We Carry, The Generations Long Fight for Justice on Native Land. It's just been great to talk with you, Rebecca Nagel, about this wonderful book.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a really fun conversation.
You can read or listen to an audio excerpt from By the Fire We Carry by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we hear from Native American storyteller and ethnohistorian Marge Bruchak. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When Thanksgiving rolls around, Native American storyteller and historian Marge Bruchac gets a lot of requests to talk about the first Thanksgiving, when the English settlers got together with the Wampanoag natives of Massachusetts for a feast. The year was 1621. Bruchac co-authored the book, 1621, A New Look at Thanksgiving. We continue our annual tradition of airing Bruchac's true story of Thanksgiving.
The entire myth of this event as the so-called first Thanksgiving, as this foundational moment in American history, is based on Edward Winslow's account of a 1621 autumn harvest feast, when he writes, "We set the last spring some 20 acres of Indian corn and sowed some 6 acres of barley and peas, and according to the manner of the Indians, we manured our ground with herrings, or rather shads, which we have in great abundance, and take with great ease at our doors. Our corn did prove well, and God be praised, we had a good increase of Indian corn, and our barley indifferent good, but our peas not worth the gathering." And he goes on to note that was the first successful harvest they had had. And being that it was a good harvest, it was time to gather together and celebrate the harvest.
So why did they choose to invite the Indians, or did they choose
to invite
the Indians?
Well, they didn't. That's the important. That's a very important detail people often miss. They did not say, let's have a harvest and invite the Indians. What they did is they started gathering all of this food, and then they decided to have some military maneuvers. And so what brought Massasoit is the fact that the Plymouth colonists, who, remember, had signed a peace treaty with Massasoit, were walking around firing off their guns, wearing their armor, and suddenly doing military maneuvers. So when Massasoit showed up with 90 men to investigate what's going on, you can tell from the records that he was suspicious. It's only after he arrives and realizes that it's a feast they're preparing for that he sends his men out, and they hunt 4 deer and bring them back. And so the largest quantity of food is not even this harvest that the colonists have brought in using native technology, using native styles of fertilizing and everything else to prepare the food. That's not the bulk of the food. The bulk of the food is the deer and the corn and the native food that Massasoit and his people bring.
Now, I have a question.
Yeah.
You've shown us how the myth differs from the reality. Well, you've shown us how the reality differs from the myth. And yet that myth is there. It's a very powerful one. What do you think that's about? Have you done any thinking about why was this myth necessary? Why was it necessary for white Americans to create a myth of friendship with the peoples that they had conquered?
The important point to make is not there was friendship. There was a negotiated friendship. The myth implies that Native people had already vanished by that moment in time, and that the few Indians who were left were invited to a feast that the English hosted. So I think the nature of the myth gives the English a sense of dominance over the landscape and over the history at a moment in time when they were, in fact, struggling and starving and about to disappear themselves.
There's something about that one big happy family.
Right, that's the mythical part, that one big happy multicultural family. That forgets the fact that this is Native landscape. It forgets the fact that the Plymouth colony is very, very small. And the entire continent of North America, the entire continent of South America, is all Indian country. Even though there have been plagues, even though there has been contact, it's all Indian country. And so what often happens is that tiny little Plymouth colony hanging on for dear life on the coast is made to look much larger than it is in fact, and is given so much more power than it has at that moment in time. And that power just extends across the continent with manifest destiny. And I think that's the danger of the myth. If it were a truer rendition of the story, you would start from the Wampanoag perspective of a long inhabited landscape, more than 12,000 years, and considering how you deal with this small band of strangers who enter into your landscape. And you would learn from the Wampanoag point of view that negotiation, reaching out, helping strangers is part of their way. And even little details like the first person to encounter the colonists is not Massasoit, it's Samoset, who is an Abenaki sachem. He's from north in what's now Maine. And he's traveled down to this territory, and he sees these people, and he knows who these people are. They've been taking captives from the coast for several decades now. There are more than 80 Native people stolen from Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, Wampanoag territory, all up and down the coast, have already been taken back to England as captives. None of these Native people are in awe at the arrival of the pilgrims, but they make a decision, and the decision they make on the spot is a negotiated peace. And I think that's what's lost in that myth of the happy family.
One of the reasons the English colonists survived is that the Wampanoag showed them how to grow corn. Marge Bruchak is a member of the Abenaki tribe. She told us her people's story of how they were given corn.
The story that we have in Abenaki territory talks about corn as a young woman who comes in the middle of winter during a starving time. And when she comes to the people, she's very tall and very lean. She has a long green dress that rustles when she walks. And she asks for a place to stay through the winter. And the people take her in, and they give her room in a lodge, and she sleeps with four grandmothers. And she spends the whole winter with the people. And through that winter, she can't speak their language, but she learns a few words. She listens to the story. She watches how the old care for the young and how the young care for the old. And when spring comes, she gathers those people together. And she says to them that she is grateful for the way they have cared for her, even though she is a stranger. She is grateful for the way they have treated her like a sister. And she has a gift to give to them. And she tells them to give them this gift, she will have to die. And the people say, "Oh no, sister, you don't have to die. We have good medicine people. We can cure you." And she says, "No, no. When I die, you will take my body and you will lay it in your fields. You will pile the earth over it and you will watch that place and my gift will come to you." And so with heavy hearts, the people do as they have been asked to do, and they take that woman's body and they lay it in the fields, and they pile the earth over it, and they watch, and they wait. And when spring comes on, a small green plant grows out of that place, and it is just the color of that woman's green dress. And it keeps growing. And as that plant gets a little taller, it has leaves that come out and they rustle, the way that woman's dress used to rustle when she walked. And the plant keeps growing. And when it gets to be as tall as that woman was tall, it grows seed pods on the side. And from each of those seed pods is hanging long strands of sandy brown hair, like that woman's hair. And when they peel open the seed pods, there's the gift. And this is the food she gives to them. And so the people right away, they give thanks, "Bemkikta, kikta, olioni," to the earth and sky for helping that plant to grow. They give thanks to that woman for coming to them. They give thanks to all of the grandmothers for looking after that woman like she was their own kin. And there's a song that goes along with that. It's called the Green Corn Song. And it's usually sung in four parts, thanking the four grandmothers that looked after that woman. And it kind of goes like this. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Oh, lalike kwe hawane yo. 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 Oh, lot of gay, one nail. Oh, lot of gay, one nail. Oh, lot of gay, one nail.
Marge Bruchak is an anthropologist, historian, and museum consultant. In addition to 1621, she's the author of other books, including the children's book Malian Song. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.